You're listening to a podcast hosted by Med Learning Group.
Welcome to the second of two podcasts on developmental and epileptic encephalopathies hosted by Med Learning Group. This two-part series is geared towards members of the multidisciplinary care team who manage epilepsy, including epileptologists, neurologists, and advanced practice providers and nurses on the care team. In our first episode, we talked about a few things, such as identification and genetic testing. In this episode, we'll be talking a little bit more about treatment strategies for these rare types of epilepsy, as well as a few concepts surrounding transitions of care. My name is Chris, and once again, I'll be the host of today's podcast. And I'm happy to have Dr. Kelly Knupp back with me. Dr. Knupp is a professor of pediatrics and neurology at the University of Colorado School of Medicine and the Children's Hospital of Colorado, and has been caring for patients with developmental and epileptic encephalopathies for many years. Dr. Knupp, welcome back. Good to have you again.
Thanks, Chris. It's good to be here.
So in our last podcast, we focused on identifying DEEs and teasing out some of the differences between them and other epilepsies with genetic testing. In this discussion for this podcast, I wanted to drill a little bit deeper into some of the treatments. Where do you start with treatment for these patients? And I know there's a lot of different types here, but, you know, say a child was just diagnosed with Dravet syndrome yesterday. What are the initial considerations for treatment?
Oh, yeah, great question. And this is a very complicated topic. And in fact, you know, we spend an entire year of additional training to try to address this as pediatric epileptologists. First and foremost, every medication decision that we make has to be a conversation with the family. Every treatment that we have has side effects. And sometimes those side effects are a benefit to the patient, and sometimes they're a detriment to the patient. And so we really need to understand the patient and the family and what signs and symptoms they're seeing so that we can make good choices. And I think that the more we partner with families, the better treatment outcomes that we have. We do have some data that helps guide us a little bit. But the truth is there, you know, while there are randomized trials for individual medications that have demonstrated efficacy for patients, it doesn't really tell us in what order to use those medications. We do, for Dravet syndrome, we do have consensus guidelines that can help guide us. And so that's usually something that I will point families to and discuss with them. The other thing that I think is really important to mention to families, particularly as they're starting off on this journey, is that we are choosing a medicine to use today. And we may actually find, given the nature of Dravet syndrome, that we have to use all of the medications and treatments that we're going to discuss over the child's lifespan. So we really are just talking about what is the best choice today, not necessarily what do you ever not want to use or always want to use. Most of the children I see with Dravet syndrome come to me already on a medication. Most often it's levetiracetam in this age population, because usually a medication is started before we actually have a genetic diagnosis confirming that diagnosis. And so I typically will then talk to families about first-line treatment options, which, depending on age, usually looks like valproic acid, clobazam, or maybe fenfluramine, although fenfluramine is not approved for children under the age of 2. And so that's something that can be very challenging to obtain for our youngest patients. And most of these patients are usually presenting with the diagnosis sometime between 9 to 18 months of age. I do talk to families about other treatment options such as stiropentol, vagus nerve stimulator, ketogenic diet, just so that these options are on their mind for the future, although this may not be something that we're starting initially. Most of our patients with Dravet syndrome, we will start with either valproic acid or clobazam before we move on to second-line therapies. But again, the emphasis is always on, you know, what are we going to start today? If this doesn't work, what do we think we would start tomorrow? And these other treatment options are things that we may need to be thinking about in the future.
Now, we talked a little bit about genetic testing in our first podcast. How do the results of a genetic test drive treatment selection for a given type of epilepsy?
Yeah. So for some of our DEEs, having a genetic test may actually lead us to literature that guides us on what's most appropriate. And then for other of our DEEs, a genetic diagnosis may not do that. So we've just spoken about Dravet syndrome, and we know that sodium channel blockers may actually exacerbate seizures in these patients. And so we would avoid things like lamotrigine, carbamazepine, oxcarbazepine. However, if a patient has a diagnosis of SCN2A, we actually know that we may actually have benefit from a sodium channel blocker. So that patient, we may actually treat with very high doses of carbamazepine or oxcarbazepine. So having that genetic diagnosis really can guide medical management and lead us to some of the medicines that are most likely to lead to an improvement in seizures and maybe even to an improvement in their underlying development and cognition.
So it seems like these rare encephalopathies are notoriously difficult to treat. So in many cases, second and third line and others are often needed when initial therapy is ineffective. So how about treatment refractory patients? Where do you start with this and how do you counsel patients on that and their families?
Yeah, I think particularly when we have a genetic diagnosis early on, it's really important to talk to families about what to expect with the natural history. Nobody wants a patient to be seizure-free more than me, except for their parents. And I think we need to make sure that we have reasonable expectations. I think we have to be very careful about not taking that hope away. The last thing we want to convey to a family is that because we're, you know, it is unlikely that we're going to reach seizure freedom, that we shouldn't at least try for it. And so every discussion needs to be about realistic expectations, our hope for seizure freedom, the progress that we've made with treatments already, and what we hope we might gain from treatments in the future. I think we need to be patient also. And I think we also need to make sure we avoid unnecessary polypharmacy. I've seen a number of patients who providers keep adding on additional medications and forget to take something else away because their goal and it really has been seizure freedom. And then their rationale is, well, since you're not seizure free, we shouldn't take a medication away. But if we're not seeing true benefit from a medication, we do need to work to try to remove that medication, even if a patient isn't seizure free.
Now, you mentioned a couple initial possible agents, lamotrigine, valproic acid, et cetera. I also wanted to mention cannabidiol, which has been controversial, particularly with over-the-counter formulations that aren't strictly regulated. There is one now that's FDA approved for, I believe, three of the DEEs. What's your experience with CBD use for these patients?
Yeah. Well, I think at the beginning you mentioned that I'm from Colorado. And so we were one of the hotbeds for oral cannabis use for epilepsy. And so we've had quite a bit of experience with our patients experimenting with these types of treatments. I have had patients who have done quite well with cannabidiol. I highly recommend that they use a pharmaceutical grade product. I think that is the only way that they know exactly what they're giving and that it's consistent from day to day and month to month. One of the challenges we've had with artisanal cannabis products is the inconsistency of the products and the lack of regulation surrounding the consistency of the products. And that's been very challenging for families and for patients as well. When possible, I always recommend that we use a pharmaceutical grade product. I think it's also really important to keep in mind that this is a medication just like everything else and has side effects just like everything else and drug interactions just like everything else. I think for a while there was sort of a myth out there that because it was natural, it was safe. And that is not true. We have many natural things in our environment that are not necessarily safe. And cannabis is no different. And so we have to also be wary of drug interactions, particularly with Depakote or clobazam, which sometimes may be to a patient's benefit. We know that using clobazam and cannabidiol in conjunction will push clobazam levels up higher in the blood, and that may actually be to the benefit of the patient. On the other hand, that could also make a patient very sleepy, and so we need to make sure that we're keeping that in check as well. And I think beyond that, we use it just like we would any other medication. It's a very reasonable medication to use, particularly in patients with Dravet syndrome or Lennox-Gastaut syndrome, where we have data.
So let's shift gears a little bit. I wanted to touch on transitions of care, which we alluded to in our first podcast a little bit. These disorders obviously rise in children, but there's a growing need to transition them through adolescence and into the adult arena in a growing number of cases. So what's your role in managing these transitions across the lifespan?
Transition of care is something that is particularly important for every institution to think about. And there are a couple of aspects that I think are really important for people to keep in mind. First of all, the patient needs to be prepared and ready to transition. And so in our practice, we really, across the practice, try to start talking about this around age 14. And the transition of kids who have fairly typical development probably looks a lot different than the transition of kids with developmental and epileptic encephalopathies. When we're talking about children who have normal cognition, we're talking to them about, how independent can they be with taking their medications? Are they able to manage a clinic visit on their own so that they can transition to an adult model of care? That is not the experience that our families with DEEs will have. Most of these children are not able to make independent decisions, are not able to take their medications on their own. And so we really need to be able to prepare families that at some point they will have to change providers. We have often cared for these families for 20 years from the time of diagnosis, from the time of presentation, the time of diagnosis, through multiple, medication choices and ups and downs of their medical history. Both providers and patients get attached to each other, and that can make transition a little bit harder. And so we want to make sure that people are prepared for that. These children also have a number of providers, and that can make it particularly challenging that if they've transitioned one provider over to an adult model of care, but not all the rest of their providers to the adult model of care, it's really difficult for providers to communicate in some situations. And if a child gets sick and needs to be admitted to the hospital, they may be do they go to the adult hospital for that or do they come to the pediatric hospital for that? Both the provider and the patient need to be prepared for this and make sure that we have this. All of the providers need to kind of be in on the same path so that things are transitioning around the same time. We also have to make sure we have providers that we can transition these patients to. The adult model of care is very different than a pediatric model of care, largely because pediatric model of care is built on family-focused care. And many of my adult colleagues do a really, really good job of that, but the vast majority of adult patients manage their own care. It's not their family that's managing their care. So we need to make sure that we have a provider who's able to provide that type of family-focused care. We have to make sure we do it in a stepwise fashion. I think that the solutions to transition are often very local. And that has to do with the fact that, we need to find appropriate adult providers who are able to provide a level of care for these complicated kids that they may not have previously been used to doing. For us in our institution, we have developed a transition clinic for neurology. We have a whole transition program for our entire institution to keep all of our providers moving in the same direction around the same time so that our patients who are transitioning their care to an adult model of care can do so both with their PCP, their neurologist, their rehab physician, their GI physician, and their pulmonary physician all around the same time so that patients don't get stuck in limbo between the two. And also making sure that we're keeping that communication open amongst all the providers and with the family.
So you mentioned the number of providers involved, and I wanted to just talk about multidisciplinary care a little bit. As the pediatric epileptologist, you're kind of in place to run the show from start to finish. But what other types of clinicians are involved along the way?
Yeah, well, I would argue that for our patients, it's actually their primary care physician who should be running the show from start to finish. So we need to make sure that our patients have a really good primary care physician who's familiar with children with special needs, who knows how to manage all of these multidisciplinary providers so that our patients have a medical home that they can go to. We are one aspect of their care. As a pediatric epileptologist, my focus is on epilepsy and managing treatments for epilepsy and maybe some of the other neurologic things that a child may have, such as headaches, spasticity, therapies, things like that. But constipation is something that shouldn't be managed by a neurologist. I don't have the most experience with that, and I'm not the specialist in that area. If somebody is having breathing issues, that needs to be managed by a pulmonologist. So I think you know, working very closely with a primary care physician, making sure that we're all staying in communication. Our electronic medical records have been very helpful with that, so that all of our records are in the same place. They're not hiding in a box in each one of our offices where nobody else can see them. And also allowing us to communicate with each other, I think, is really helpful.
So let's finish up on this in the time we have left. How would you describe the current clinical state of these rare epilepsy conditions? Not individually, because there's so many of them, but do you think we're in a good spot in getting better with, say, aspects of identification and treatment? Or are there specific needs and goals that we need to put in place to hone in a little bit more?
When I think about where we are now compared to 20 years ago, I think we are in a much better place. I think that we have, you know, improved access to genetic testing, which means earlier diagnosis of specific etiologies. With the internet, families are able to communicate with each other, and so they no longer feel like they're the only one who has this diagnosis. And both parents and providers, we learn when we cohort patients so that we can offer, you know, the best therapies that we know about. I think we also seen gene modulatory therapies on the horizon, which is really exciting. We have had a number of new medications that have become available for these patient populations, which is also exciting. My one caution with that, though, is that when we look at the data, while we have a number of new treatment options for our patients, we still have the same number of patients who are not seizure-free. And so I think that the number of medications gives us a lot of tools in our toolbox and may be really helpful for an individual patient. But when we look at the overall population, I think that really we're just managing to have sort of the same number of patients that are seizure-free, but with fewer side effects. And so I think we still have a long ways to go. I think that our patients also have increasingly a culture of being interested in research, which I think is going to be key for this. I think that we are behind the times when I compare to my colleagues in oncology. They have had a culture of research for, you know, about 50 years now, and that has significantly improved the outcomes of children with oncologic disease. And I think that we are just at the beginning of that, where we are, you know, now starting to rigorously keep track of how our patients are doing, what therapies are working, what therapies aren't working, and preparing our patients to participate in clinical trials so that we can improve therapies as we move forward. So while I think we're in a better place than we were before, I see really good things on our horizon. But I don't think we're in the best place we can be until every single patient is seizure-free. And so we have a long ways to go.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Knupp. That's all the time we have for today. But I do appreciate you, and I appreciate your work with these children, as well as your insights here today with our two podcasts. But I do wish you the best in continuing to manage these challenging patients in your own practice as well. And thanks to all of our listeners for joining us as well. I welcome you to listen to the first podcast in the series, in which we talked about diagnosis and assessment a little bit more. MedLearning Group also has several other podcasts and CME programs, many of which are on neurology topics, on our website, www.medlearninggroup.com. This podcast was brought to you by MedLearning Group. MedLearning Group is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. This CME activity was planned and produced in accordance with ACCME Essentials. I would also like to give a special thank you to our educational grant supporter, Jazz Pharmaceuticals, who provided an unrestricted educational grant for this activity. Have a great day.